Welcome to Nature Bags Last in the Regressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM this April 19th, 2016 edition, episode 86 of Nature Bags Last comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico with our live studio audience of one.
And he's quiet, too.
Yeah. Don't let him loose. Our thanks to Afrozen for his theme song contribution. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. This is a call-in show, and it's Kevin Hester, so you better call in. Please prepare those questions and get ready to give us a toll-free call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. As I mentioned, we are joined today by longtime sailor and activist Kevin Hester, and Kevin is calling from his home in New Zealand. Kevin is a New Zealand-born member of the Irish Republican diaspora. After growing up in a working-class immigrant family in rural New Zealand, he became an activist in the anti-nuclear, anti-apartheid, and environmental campaigns, which culminated in New Zealand becoming a nuclear-free in the early 1980s. In 1981, during the Mozambique Civil War, Hester worked on a development project in Beira, Mozambique, with very mixed results, making it the second war zone he had lived in after a period in Republican West Belfast during some of the most torrid times. His personal tipping point for delving deeply into our planetary emergency was the triple meltdown at Fukushima Daiichi in Japan. A longtime sailor, Hester has captained several ocean passages. He's an avid researcher who writes and speaks about a wide array of environmental issues and social justice. Welcome to Nature Bags Last in the Progressive Radio Network, Kevin Hester.
Kia ora, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here on a beautiful sunny day, beautiful summer's day in the middle of autumn in Auckland, and we're just off the coast of Auckland, New Zealand.
Right on, man. So let's get started a little bit. You know, you mentioned in your bio a little bit of your personal tipping points. Let's talk about your journey from climate change to abrupt climate change to near-term human extinction. Maybe take us along that path and some of the things that brought you where you are today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as you said in the intro, you know, I've been involved a lot in environmental stuff for a long time. And I've always been – I don't know why I got so captivated with the nuclear issue, but it was a really big one in New Zealand, and it was formative times for me. And – a lot of us environmentalists, we fight these battles and we very rarely have any wins. But we had a spectacular win in New Zealand when we convinced our reluctant government that to become nuclear free, and we set a benchmark for the whole world. So to a degree, I think we fell into the trap of thinking that we'd won that battle. And then, of course, in March 2011, the tsunami that struck the power plant at Fukushima Daiichi changed all that. And since then, you know, for over 5 years now, three coriums that have melted through primary and almost certainly secondary containment have escaped into the ground. And those pathetic idiots from TEPCO who built those six power stations stations on a fault line on a dry riverbed. There's artesianal water that's flowing beneath those dry riverbeds into the Pacific Ocean, and they are now flowing over those coriums. So for 5 years, there's been radioactive water, really highly radioactive water, pouring into the ocean. And I think for me, that was the tipping point that said, all your worst fears have come to pass. And then I stuck my head down the rabbit hole, and all I could see was absolute Armageddon. And I'm going to be really honest here. You know, around that time, Guy McPherson came into my life through Robin Westenra and Michael Rupert. And when I first heard about what Guy was saying, I thought, no way, it can't be that bad. Yeah, sure, the shit's hit the fan. It's really bad, but it can't be that bad. And I spent a couple of years keeping my mouth shut and listening to what people were saying and not engaging and trying to find ways to prove that Guy was wrong. And I'm really sad about the fact that I failed on that mission and that I am 100% behind what Guy's saying. And I think that we're staring down the barrel of near-term human extinction. And it could be much sooner than Guy's saying. You know, Guy's benchmark figure is something like that he can't see that there will be humans beyond 2030. But that's not saying that that's the cutoff date, like the magic 2100 that everyone else is saying. I think that we are looking at a situation that complex life on this planet could be extinguished any day.
Yeah, you know, we interviewed Helen Caldicott a few weeks ago, and I asked her specifically about Fukushima and if she thought it was an extinction event, and she didn't, and I don't necessarily think it's an extinction event on a human level. But what would be an extinction event as far as maybe power plants, in your estimation?
Well, what I would say is that the moment that Fukushima Daiichi happened, the planet that we lived on became extinct, and we started living on a completely different – in a different paradigm. One of the things that happens with radionuclides is they bioaccumulate and they attack the genetic structure of whatever organism that they're getting into. So that means that as it goes down through the generations, that organism is being changed, fundamentally changed in a way that evolution could never have done. So from the moment that happened, the planet that we lived on ceased to exist. You could say that that happened from the day that that Rutherford, a New Zealander by chance, split the atom. Well, he was one of a team that split the atom. Our planet changed that day. Albert Einstein said the same thing. He said that he knew that the moment the atom was split, that it was the death sentence for the human species.
And not long after that, he said, if I had known what they were going to do with it, referring to the ability to split atoms, he said, I would have become a shoemaker.
He had some great shoes.
So you were a sailor, Kevin, for a long time. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your sailing history and how you saw the ocean changing from beginning to end during that, however long it was, and remind us again how many ocean passages and how long you were out there sailing.
Well, in total, I've done 16 ocean passages, and that's by the definition of the Royal Yacht Association, where I got my yacht masters in Gibraltar, of all places. An ocean passage is 350 miles minimum of open blue water. So on some of the very big trips I've done, they qualify as three ocean passages. I did one trip once from Micronesia in the central northern Pacific across the equator down to the Solomon Islands, past Papua New Guinea, across the Coral Sea to Cairns. And then I sailed down the whole length of the Great Barrier Reef to Brisbane, and then I brought the yacht back to New Zealand. So in total, that was about 5,000 miles, but equated to three ocean passages between the two big pieces of blue water. When I went to Cairns, I've been a diver pretty much all my adult life. And when I went to Cairns, I was, you know, obviously I was dead keen to get in and have a look at the Great Barrier Reef. And I went and attended a seminar run by a wonderful Irish marine biologist. This is 15 years ago. And at the beginning of the seminar, talk about a great punchline to start. He said, turn to the person beside you, pat them on the back, and congratulate them for being the last generation to ever dive the Great Barrier Reef while it was still alive.
Wow.
And, you know, like Guy's message, I just thought, oh, he's being alarmist. It can't be that bad. That's a 15-year-old story, and now we're standing here, we're looking at the Great Barrier Reef having this incredibly traumatic bleaching event. And exactly what he said is coming to pass in the time frame that he said. If it reflects what your sort of time frames are, Guy, we're in deep, deep shit.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. Don't bother holding back. Tell us what you really think. So you brought up the coral reef, and specifically the Great Barrier Reef. Can you talk a little bit about the dying reefs, what you've actually seen when you were on the ocean, and what you're reading about now?
Okay, well, look, when we talk about tipping points, when I first started sailing, we used to be sailing through, you know, obviously when you're ocean passage making, you sail 24 hours a day, and you do watches. So someone goes and has a sleep. Most of those trips was only me and one other person, or two or three other people on the slightly bigger yachts. But what would happen in during the day, all day, you'd see flying fish flying around, and what they're doing is they're either chasing bait fish on the top, or they're being chased by other fish. And, you know, the brutality of the reality of the natural world is incredible. We're one of the only species that doesn't have a predator, although in Africa people would say that's not quite true. But as a general rule, we're not predated by another species. But those flying fish would be flying around, and they'd hit the sails or they'd hit the deck, and they'd flop around either concussed or knocked out or killed. And we would pick them up and have them for breakfast. You know, it was the easiest way to catch fish is to pick it up out of the cockpit.
Right.
But what happened, excuse me, what happened over that time is I stopped seeing them. And that was a real eye-opener for me. But of course, because I didn't have the science background that I've learned subsequently, is that I just put it down to overfishing. And obviously, to a degree, overfishing is a massive problem. But the problem now is that our oceans are warming and acidifying and dying. And when I first dived those Great Barrier Reefs, it was just incredible. It was like swimming through a rainforest. There were species everywhere. You know, there's thousands of species on the Great Barrier Reef. And there were fish everywhere, and there's all of these different flora and fauna. It was just spectacular. And even then, you could see tiny places where there'd been die-off. But it wasn't the bleaching. It was from nitrogen runoff and pollution from the mainland. So, you know, in that time that I've been diving and sailing around, I have watched a transformation take place. And in geologic times, that quarter of a century is a blink in the eye. Talking about the Great Barrier Reef, Professor Terry Hughes, who's the director of the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for Coral Reef Studies at James Cook University in Townsville, he did his survey by helicopter and plane, and he wrote on March the 26th that it's the saddest trip of my life.
Mm.
From the 22nd of March, Hughes crisscrossed 520 individual reefs in 4 days, covering about 3,200 kilometres by air. In that time, and over those 520 reefs that they looked at, and this is from the air, remember, just four of them showed no evidence of bleaching. And he described it as the most heartbreaking event of his life.
Wow.
And I'm sure if he'd have got down into the water, the ones that didn't look like they'd been bleaching would have shown signs of it.
We interviewed Doug Peacock on this program 2 months ago, and he has spent much of his life in the close proximity of grizzlies. He knows we're not necessarily living in a predator-free world, too, but there aren't very many people who have had those kinds of experiences where they purposely go out there and put themselves in a situation where they're not at the top of the food chain.
Right.
I think we should all try that now and then to give us a little humility that we're generally lacking. This is a call-in show. We're interviewing Kevin Hester. Give us a toll-free call at 888-874-4888. Kevin has had a varied set of life experiences and is well-versed on topics, particularly those that represent an existential threat to humans on Earth.
Kevin, you, I don't know anyone, at least in the what I call the doomer circle, that posts significant amount of information more than you. And I was wondering, you know, what you're generally looking for when you're going to post something, and what's your point? What's your purpose? What do you hope to accomplish?
A lot of the things that I do and what I say is based on my experience of being a skipper on yachts. When you're the skipper, you have an obligation to keep the boat safe, to keep the passengers safe, to keep the crew safe, and to keep anyone that could be involved with the boat safe. What I'm seeing is I'm seeing a catastrophe unfolding, and it's my obligation to warn my crew and my fellow passengers about how bad the situation is. I think we have that moral obligation. And especially when we see this complete bankruptcy of leadership from our supposed leaders all around the world, where all they're concerned with doing is keeping business as usual going. And I think the big NGOs and the big green movements, political green movements, are completely in breach of their fiduciary duty or their responsibility to people with regard to that. So my purpose of doing this is to try and wake people up to how bad the situation is and the fact that it's not a linear progression. You know, right. This is one of the most important things that people have to realize. Al Bartlett, a famous scientist, did this fantastic presentation that you can see on YouTube about the exponential function. And he described it as being one of the greatest weaknesses of the human species, the inability to understand the exponential function. I firmly believe that we're in an exponential unraveling of the biosphere, and I think it will collapse at an enormous and very fast speed. So my this all the time, and you know, I've got a love-hate relationship with Facebook. I hate it mostly, and I love it for the fact that it's a great aggregator for information and a source to get it out. But as a general rule, we're only talking to the converted and the different ecological groups we're in and the different communities that we interact with. The dominant culture would call the lumpen proletariat, who's the general working class people who do all the work on this planet, they're also busy trying to stay on the treadmill and keep their heads above water, that they don't get a chance to have a look and do the research that some of us are doing.
Right.
So that's my purpose.
Yeah, it seems to me that I was listening to a community radio station this morning, and there was an environmentalist on from the state of New Mexico, and It seems to me that the standard line for most environmentalists is all they're trying to do now is hold the line, so to speak, and failing miserably at it because they're just getting crushed by industry and quote-unquote progress. And it was a really sad interview to listen to because I could just tell this guy had been beat down his entire career. And he knew he was in a losing battle, you know, and he's trying to basically – He was talking about coyotes and the reputation coyotes have in this country, and in particular this state, and how there is no season for coyotes. It's all season. Mm-hmm. And they have killing contests to see how many coyotes they can kill, and they get prize money for this kind of thing here. And that's just – it just seems to me that when I listen to most people who are trying to do things through the system, it's that I can't understand – why they cannot get beyond jumping through these particular hoops, the hoops that are actually, you know, killing us. And that's why it's hard to have folks like that on. And it's refreshing to have folks like you on. Let's take a call from Angie in California. Angie, do you have a question?
Angie, are you still with us?
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead, Angie. Oh.
I wanted to say hi to Kevin and to Guy and to you, Mike, and to your studio audience. and we're still here. We still have another day. And no real questions, just wanted to connect and looking forward to the next 5 to 10 years, right?
Nice.
If we're so lucky, right?
Or the next 5 to 10 minutes.
5 to 10 minutes, right. With so much going on all over the planet, and, you know, you were talking a little bit about the scientists who have to tow the line of
right.
Of we don't know what's happening and we can't really predict what's happening and what's another good one that they say
if we start right now we can fix it.
My favorite one is faster than previously thought.
Yeah, that's a great one too.
Yeah, what is it about hopelessness, right? Why do we avoid that at all costs, or why does the media avoid that at all costs? What, you know, I often think, what if they got on television and on the radio and in the print materials that are given out to people and... just what if the media just told it like it was? That it would usurp the corporations, and that's what we all know needs to be done, right?
Yeah, but those media outlets work for the corporations. They're owned by the corporations.
Right, but those corporations are human beings, and call me an optimist. Those human beings, are they that drugged? I mean, you know, is it? Do they have to take sleeping pills? Have they been injected with some kind of?
Yes. Will you mention your story with your brother?
Who are you guys talking to me?
Yeah. Oh, I totally agree. I mean, I think from what I've heard and what I've read and what I feel in the world is that we who are living in the civilized world are infected with the virus of progress, success, and we can't see beyond anything that isn't in the growth paradigm. Even people that I've respected for years, and people that have incredible reputations, like Dr. Helen Caldicott, cannot get out of the, well, if we can just get the right person in office, well,
right.
We can make a change.
If we just switch to solar panels right now, right. It'll all be fine. Thank you for calling
in.
Can I make a comment about
Angie's comment there about the narrative?
Yes, please do.
What I've seen in the last really short time, like perhaps in the last 12 or 18 months, is that the whole narrative in the mainstream media has changed. Whilst there's been this big debate until recently, is climate change actually happening? Now we see major organizations talking about climate change. But what they're doing is they're still controlling the narrative as they always have. The magical number that we always hear now is 2100. Interestingly, it's a very nice round number where everything is based on what's going to happen in 2100 and what the sea level rise will be in 2100 and what the models tell us are happening about 2100. Well, I believe that there's a concerted effort by the mainstream media to now they know that they can't bullshit people into thinking that this disaster is not unfolding. So they've just moved the goalposts out by 85 years. And they're saying, oh, yeah, those poor generations, the poor kiddies in 2100, there'll be no Great Barrier Reef. Well, the reality is that 90% of the oxygen on this planet is coming out of the ocean. The ocean is turning into an acidic soup. There'll be no oxygen coming out of that ocean in 2100. I'll be surprised if there's a tree on this planet when we're above 4 degrees C, above baseline, which is this arbitrary baseline of 1870, which forgets about all of the warming that happened in the previous 50 years. I really would like people to question the narrative all the time. I see people posting articles without any kind of critique of them. And those articles, whilst they're talking about climate change, are pure and utter disinformation. If I can get anyone who's listened to the show to do anything afterwards, it would be to question everything. Question what I say, question what Mike and Guy say, and
Whoa.
Question everything.
You're right. Sorry, Kevin.
I was just waiting for that chuckle. Everyone who knows MBL have been waiting for that chuckle.
No, you're absolutely right. Nobody questions anything. You know, our education system here, as Guy and I both, you know, suffered through as students and teachers, there is no critical thinking anymore. Maybe there was way in the beginning, a little bit, but everything is about just taking the narrative and digesting it and then, you know, regurgitating it back for a particular score. So there's no thought process on your own. You're handed a particular story and you try and navigate that story without ever questioning it. And my definition of intelligence completely changed once I became aware of the story I was telling myself about myself. Because people who I thought were very smart, well, there was no deviation from that narrative, and there never will be. And it completely changed how I viewed the world. It turned my world upside down.
And now those people don't seem so swift, do they?
No, and well, they don't talk to me.
That's what I said. They don't seem so swift. You're listening to Nature Bass Last on the Progressive Radio Network. We're taking your calls toll-free at 888-874-4888. And we have one in the queue, Kevin. So could you give us just a couple of minutes answer, and then we'll go to Morris in Brooklyn?
Sure. I just want to go back to the last thing we were talking about with Angie about activists. And yes, the activists in the West have gone down this road of talking about sustainability and the like, that, you know, which is completely impossible. There's nothing sustainable about industrial civilization. But what I have to remind people of is that activists in Central and South America and in Africa are being murdered every day. You know, it's not just an academic exercise for activists in those places or who are like where we are, who are trying to do things and not winning. Over there, they're being shot, strangled, and murdered all the time. And I believe that will happen to all of us at the end of this dystopian story, where when they can't control the narrative, they will control the people who they can't control. So, you know, now I describe these as the good old days. I think people should remember that. Sorry to interrupt. Let's get back to your new guest.
No, that's fine. We're having the show to focus on you and your work, after all, and your thoughts.
Okay.
We do have a call from Morris in Brooklyn. Morris, are you still with us?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Hi. I'm wondering, we have doomers such as Paul Beckwith, who are fully familiar with all the extinction possibilities, but insist that there's still a remote but definite possibility to prevent a catastrophe. So I'm wondering, why not, and I've heard you say, Guy, you're 99.9% sure, you backed off at least on one occasion from saying you're 100% sure. So I'm wondering, why not give his solutions a chance? I'd like to get an opinion from all of you. I respect all of your opinions.
Go, Kevin.
I'm going to give everything a chance. If anyone has something that they think is a solution, I'm prepared to entertain it. But as a skipper, what my role is to follow the precautionary principle all the time. Look at the worst case scenario. I've been watching the barometer plunge on this planet. What that tells me is that there's the biggest shitstorm in the history of this planet heading our way. Absolutely. Hope that something will come up. Look for some kind of solution, but prepare for the worst. And the worst is the extinction of most, if not all, complex life forms on this planet bearing down on us imminently. I love Paul's work, and I admire a lot of what Paul does. And I'm not going to get into some kind of debate about whether Paul's right or wrong or whether Guy's right or wrong. I think people should follow their instinct, do whatever they think is right, and enjoy every day like it's their last.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. I always wonder, you know, what is it exactly we think we're trying to solve? Because it seems to me every time we come up with a solution for, you know, whatever it may be, it seems to be centered around us, which is exactly what put us here in the first place. So if all of our activities and all of our efforts are always about us, it seems to me that we just kind of keep going in circles and revolving to the same point, which is the predicament that we're in. I don't know if many of us who have been born and raised in quote-unquote captivity are capable of not putting ourselves first. I mean, there are people on this planet, you know, that's all they've done, but we're slowly wiping them off and absorbing them as well. So I really don't know exactly what we're trying to solve when we keep it, it's always about us. And until it's not about us, I don't really see entertaining some of those particular aspirations.
Well, yeah. Paul Beckwith promotes the idea of solar radiation management, and he actually founded a company to make money implementing solar radiation management. So I don't think he's necessarily an unbiased voice on the topic, like follow the money. In addition, there's abundant evidence published in very conservative refereed journal literatures indicating that solar radiation management will make matters worse, not better, with respect to climate change. And to follow up on Mike's comment, the universe has been around for, as nearly as we can tell, about 13.8 billion years, and humans showed up, Homo sapiens, our species, and therefore our favorite species, showed up about 200,000 years ago. We think it's all about us? Really? we're a speck on a speck, and we're really late to the party.
Yeah.
And so I think a focus not on humans, much less humans living the industrialized world, might be a step in the right direction to focus on non-human species and so-called uncivilized or pre-civilized humans. That might be one way to go as well.
Human centrism is the root cause of the extinction of all complex life on this planet. Because it's always been about us, this is how we got into this predicament. If we'd had any dignity and any respect for the biosphere that we live as a part of, we wouldn't be in this. No other species has ever behaved like the arsonist crackpots, carbon smokers that we are.
Wow. I love that quote. That's a great t-shirt. That's brilliant. Yeah. Awesome.
Well, you know, it's important. It's important that we have a laugh. This is really important. I want everyone in this community to look for an opportunity of self-depreciation and to have a laugh at ourselves. If humans were able to laugh at themselves a little more, a little better, maybe we wouldn't have taken ourselves so seriously and marched the ecology of the planet off the precipice.
Absolutely. All right, we have another caller. We have Matt from Florida. Matt, you have a question.
Hi, Kevin, Mike, Guy. It's good to hear from you guys. Haven't listened to the show in a while. And I think your question, Mike, that, you know, what are we trying to solve was just so enlightened. I just wanted to say that again so the listeners can hear that. And Paul Beckwith, by the way, just came out with a pro-nuclear dimming effect to offset climate change. And I think if we've got our top scientists, or at least our most published scientists, talking about creating nuclear war to solve this problem, then I think we now have some agreement of just how big this problem really is. The John W. Whitehead, who has a website called governmentofwolves.com, has summed up what Kevin was just describing of the frustrations of the messengers. And I think one of the cool things about what Kevin mentioned was that he had success, that he had helped, you know, turn New Zealand into a nuclear-free world. And I wanted to ask him what he thinks the odds are, given our current electronic surveillance network that's in place right now, what do you think the odds are of pulling that off now?
Zero. Zero. probably less than that.
Oh, we're into negative interest rate territory.
We're into, yeah. Okay, we know that works. Just keep blowing. It'll inflate. Now, what I think is there's been a transition in my lifetime. We lived in fractious times, you know, when I was a young fellow. I'm 56, so, you know, I'm old. But when I was first in activism, we didn't live in unrestricted fascism in those days. But I firmly believe that the West is controlled by unadulterated fascism. In the United States, you have a president who has the ability to sign the death warrant on anyone, anywhere in the world, even United States citizens, interestingly enough, because he's killed American people as well. The whole system is dystopian. There is no semblance of democracy anymore. It's a corporate coup has taken place. So in answer to your question, would we have the ability to pull off what we did in the 1980s? I would say to you, no chance whatsoever.
Yeah, I really couldn't agree more. It's increasingly clear that democratic principles have been abandoned throughout the so-called free world. We do have another caller, Gary from Hawaii. Are you still with us? What do you got?
Ed, can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can.
I just want to start off, please, by commending all you guys. I just... Who am I to criticize? I mean, really, you guys, week after week, make your lives all about trying to bring some kind of awareness. And I really appreciate what you do, and I don't feel that it's really my place. I mean, okay, let me just try to make a suggestion and hope that it will further the conversation, because I've been listening to you guys just regularly, and I know that you're getting tired of saying the same sort of stuff to people who largely aren't listening. What I've observed in the tone of your resignation is a little bit, and again, I'm not criticizing, it's just an observation, I hope it's taken constructively, that there's a little bit of a smugness around having come to terms with this concept of the five stages of grief. And when you hear other people who have not fully gone through this process as deeply as you guys have, you will either, you're very reserved. You're very reserved. You don't insult them while they're expressing their point of view. But after they're off the line between and amongst you, you will mention how futile their point of view ultimately is. And so what I would like to do is suggest an additional point of view for you guys to look at, that there's a possibility that you may not have fully understood the five stages of grief, and I would like to challenge you to perhaps explore the word extrapolation. To extrapolate something is to take something to its full conclusion. It takes it all the way. And part of the extrapolation that I'm trying to, I'll try to get to the point here and not take up too much time, but the very definition, the very examination of global warming and climate change may not be the problem. The very terminology, the very approach that it is not, that it is the problem that needs to be solved may not be the problem. What if it's the solution? What if the earth and the ecosystem needs to go through this eye of the needle, so to speak, and just basically cleanse the whole thing. And if that means people and the larger life forms, that's not the end of life. That's just the end of life as we know it, as Earth comes back into some semblance of balance. And it may take thousands of years, and nobody wants to hear that. But if you really understand the five stages of grief, you have to take it beyond that and recognize that what people really don't want to hear is that the Earth changes are the solution. It's not the problem that needs to be solved. And that just casts such an ugly light on people in general that nobody wants to hear that. And if you're honest with yourselves and you want to be honest with your audience, you have to really be speaking in the very, very ugliest of terms. It's so uncomfortable. I don't want you guys to sound like that. I don't want to put you to this. But it's the truth. It's the real truth when you extrapolate this whole scenario to its logical end. And further, and I'll close by making a last point, and that is, along the understanding of extrapolation, that means taking something all the way to its full conclusion. If there was one individual on Earth, one human being, or a dozen, or a thousand human beings, and these human beings were totally, absolutely, ultimately irreverent of the environment and other life forms and other everything, it wouldn't make one iota of difference if there were a million people who were absolute, just the worst possible things life forms could possibly be. But if you extrapolate and take 7, 8, 9, 10 billion people, and every single one of them were recycling and no carbon emissions and this and that and whatever it is, as soon as you extrapolate and see that the population is the real issue that nobody wants to talk about, they want someone else to stop having kids, but it's a basic human function. It's your birthright, and everybody wants to have as many kids as they possibly can, or whatever's comfortable for them. And when you extrapolate the very numbers, it doesn't matter however many billions of people there are who are total environmentalists and have gone through the five stages of grief.
And Gary, can you cut to the chase for us?
It won't make any difference. The only issue, the top line and the bottom line, and the only issue that you guys need to be talking about is population. Thanks for giving me so much time.
Absolutely. Thank you, Gary. You make a lot of good points. As far as smugness goes, I'm guilty as charged. I have to catch myself usually on an hourly basis because, and this is not an excuse by any stretch of the imagination, this stuff, it wears thin after a while. And yeah, I do get disappointed and I do get frustrated that people, quote unquote, don't get it on some levels. And I'm not setting the bar all that high. I'm just, as Kevin brought up earlier, I'm just looking for people to just question and to just do the simplest of things. Wake up every day, and when you hear things and see things, you know, question it, because that seems to be the one thing that is missing. So that's probably my biggest frustration. And yeah, I'm guilty of being smug at times.
I'm more smug than he is.
No, you're not. Yeah, so as far as your other point, population, it's a huge, huge issue, and you're right. It's a topic I think that does not get covered nearly enough. We add about 238,000 births minus deaths a day. That's never on the news, and quite frankly, it's not on this show enough either. We've mentioned it from time to time, and it's something, again, I think that we just kind of skim over because it's one of those things that's just constant. But yeah, you're right. You made a lot of good points. And if we go all the way down to the root and beyond, maybe the Earth is shaking us off. And that's not such a bad thing after all.
Well, yeah. And I mean, taking the rational perspective, the scientific perspective, it is what it is, right? The Earth is going to shake us off. We need not express an opinion about that. Every species goes extinct, and that includes ours.
Yeah.
As Gerardo Ceballos said in an interview coincident with the affirmation of the sixth great extinction, he said, ours will likely be among the early species to leave in the midst of the sixth great extinction. So, of course, we depend so heavily upon the other species.
Right.
Kevin, you have a thought for us?
I think that everyone who's going through this dichotomy deals with the grief in different ways, and your last guest made that very clear, and my heart goes out to him and all of us about how we deal with this grief. I was fortunate enough recently, I was invited by Paula Molisa. Paula is a lecturer at Victoria University in Wellington, and hopefully, Guy, we will be speaking on your upcoming New Zealand tour in November. Hopefully we'll be speaking with Paula at Victoria. And he invited me to go to a climate change conference and speak. And I did, but the biggest takeout from me was that I heard all of these indigenous people talking about life on Kiribati, excuse me, and Tuvalu and the islands in the Pacific. And these people were really emotional. They got up and they cried. They did all of the things that the Anglo-Saxons don't do. And it's really important for people to get those emotions out and express them. I've had people say to me that when I've spoken at different events saying that, and they're all Anglo-Saxons, they come up and say, oh, you shouldn't be so emotional. Well, excuse me. We're talking about the extinction of all complex life on the planet. Fucking forgive me if I'm emotional.
Again, thanks for holding back, Kevin. We appreciate your discretion on the air.
You didn't expect me to do anything, but...
You know, it's weird because I watch one of my favorite shows of all time is Flight of the Conchords, and those guys are pretty mellow, but you're not mellow at all.
I'm much more mellow than I sing.
Yeah, you're not like Brit.
We have time for one more call. Rob from Canada, are you still with us? What you got for us?
Yeah, no, I'm still here. All right, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, great. I honestly usually listen like recorded on Stitcher, but I just had a chance to call. I don't know if it's relevant to what you've been talking about, but I just had a question. I think I'm in the first stage, which is denial, because I'm still trying to understand, you know, the whole issues. And you showed on one of your lectures that I saw on YouTube that most of the time, for the last 4.5 billion years, Earth has been around 22 degrees, so hot. During the dinosaur age, the Cretaceous and the Jurassic was 22 degrees above zero, I guess, or baseline. I'm not really sure what the temperature is. And then it dips down to an ice age, and then in a very short period of time in an ice age, and that's where we are now. But life existed then, like at 22 degrees. I mean, there were dinosaurs, but it existed. And even at that time, there were mammals that eventually became us. So why is it this time when the temperature goes rocketing up, does everything die?
Well, it's the pace of change that we're looking at now. Temperature is rising already much, much faster than it ever has in human history. The most rapid increase in temperature was reported in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences a few years ago, and that was over a span of 13 years, there was a 5 degree Celsius temperature rise. And that's the fastest ever reported in the journal literature. That's from the PETM. And it exceeds by orders of magnitude any other rapid increase in temperature. The problem with that sort of rapid increase in temperature, and it appears that we're going even faster now and have the potential to go much, much faster in the near future. The difficulty with that is not that we're not clever. We go in and outside of buildings all the time, and we get cold and we get hot, and we have clothes and we have fossil fuels to warm and cool us. The problem is that the rest of the living planet doesn't have those advantages. So I can't imagine there will be a tree on the planet that's alive, we get to 4 degrees Celsius above baseline in a matter of a few years. That's this primary problem that we are failing largely to recognize here, is that it's only about humans because humans depend upon so many other organisms. Microbes and bacteria will be fine. More complex life forms will not, with extremely rapid increases in global average temperature. The two relatively stable states that you mention over long periods of time for planet Earth are 12 degrees Celsius and 22 degrees Celsius. That's global average temperature. But going from one to the other in a really rapid period of time doesn't give organisms that we depend upon an opportunity to keep up, to catch up with that level of rapid change. So thanks for the question.
And to follow on from that, once we fall over, so do the 450 nuclear power stations that are on the planet and the 1,200 spent fuel pool fires. So there'll be a pretty big cataclysmic change on the atmosphere when that happens as well.
Yeah, there's some 1,200 pools holding spent fuel rods. And when the water drains out of the cooling ponds because the electricity fails or because people don't show up for work or because of a number of other reasons, the planet is going to experience fires like it's never witnessed before, 1,200 of them or so, spewing ionizing radiation all over the planet. So that seems problematic to me.
Yeah.
Imagine how much of the remaining oxygen those fires will consume.
Right.
Hey, I know we're coming to the wind-up stage. There was just one more thing that I would like to talk about before we get to the end, is that we're talking all the time about how this ecological crisis is going to unfold and how quickly it will unfold, but very little talk, and this is back to the mainstream media controlling the narrative, is going to be how the political and military response to this dichotomy will be. The Pentagon describes climate change as a threat multiplier. When the Pentagon uses the word threat multiplier, we all know what's going to happen. I think that one of the things is way before we get to complete and utter ecological collapse, we will get to a societal collapse and a world of all of these psychopaths that have thousands of nuclear weapons. They will start throwing those weapons at each other. And one of your callers mentioned Paul's presentation about a nuclear winter, which is a really well-known phenomenon. I spoke about it recently on a Counterpunch interview that I did. But I want to point out that Paul wasn't advocating for it. Paul was saying this could happen. It will work. I think people misrepresented what Paul said in that, and he could have presented it possibly a little bit better. He wasn't suggesting we do it. He was suggesting that it would work and that possibly it will be used. And I believe 100% that how the human story will come to an end is that the nuclear weapons that have been built and never got to be used will be used, and this planet will be left bathing in ionizing radiation after we leave.
Well, it's nice to know that I'm not the most pessimistic person on the air today. Thank you very much for joining us, Kevin Hester. It's been a pleasure to have this conversation.
Thanks, Kevin.
For me, it's been an honor. I'm really honored that you gave me the opportunity. Thanks. I love you both a lot.
All right.
Thank you.
Take care, brother.
Thank you very much.
All right, Guy, got a climate update?
I do. Climate warming is predicted to reduce omega-3 long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acid production in phytoplankton. That, a direct quote from the title of a paper in the April 12, 2016 online edition of Global Change Biology. These essential fatty acids from ocean-dwelling plankton are vital to the health of all vertebrates, with a direct relationship to cardiovascular and immune system health, as well as neurological function, vision, and reproduction. The situation on land is worsening, too, as a result of climate change. Rising levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide have reduced protein in goldenrod pollen, a key late-season food source for North American bees. The title of a paper in the April 13, 2016 issue of Proceedings of the Royal Society B tells the story, quote, "Rising atmospheric CO2 is reducing the protein concentration of a floral pollen source essential for North American bees. Without bees to pollinate land plants, humans are going to have a tough time. Hmm. Here's a headline from Climate Central on April 15th, 2016. Quote, new milestone, Earth sees 11 record hot months in a row, end quote. That's right. Each of the last 11 months has set a record for the hottest month ever recorded. That's not really going in the right direction.
No, it isn't.
From the April 18th, 2016 issue of Nature Geoscience comes a paper reporting that ocean acidification is an important consequence of the release of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere from fossil fuel burning. Specifically, when excess atmospheric CO2 reacts with seawater, it forms carbonic acid, which acidifies the ocean, causing dramatic changes in ocean ecosystems. The Arctic Ocean is particularly sensitive to such changes. This latest study proposes a novel mechanism for Arctic Ocean acidification involving release and subsequent breakdown of organic matter from thawing permafrost and carbon-rich river runoff in seawater. In other words, melting of permafrost on land leads to accelerating acidification of the ocean. Mm-hmm. A final note from me regarding my upcoming speaking tour in California, there will be a potluck dinner on May 1st in the East Bay. Mm-hmm. You can get details by emailing info@guymcphersontour.com. I'd love to meet local listeners in person. We might even get to talk about dying. Oh, and living too. I look forward to seeing you in the East Bay. Again, that email address is info@guymcphersontour.com if you want details.
And bring cake.
That about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like us on Facebook, our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last and Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address in the show, and please share widely the link and information from this show. And continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com and my work at The Good Men Project. For further updates, essays, and speaking tours, check out Guy's website. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll interview professor and author Sean Prentice, best known for his book Finding Abby. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM or at Stitcher.com and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to our studio audience, to our callers, and to Kevin Hester and to Aprazin for his music. Until next time, remember the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
Nature Bats Last.
Nature, she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.